Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers.
For this week's Unintended Consequence, I want to talk about payday lending. This is one of these unintended consequences that arises from a well-meaning law intended to protect people, and it actually ends up hurting the very people it's intended to protect. In this case, we have payday lenders, and these are small shops that will loan you money for a short period of time, well, until your next paycheck comes along. So we're talking days, possibly number of weeks. And the interest they charge is remarkably high. As you can understand, we're dealing with people who are high risk, you know, people who are living paycheck to paycheck like that. And so the payday lenders will charge a high rate of interest. And along come the politicians and say, look, this is wrong. This is exploitation. We need to put an end to it. And so they stop the payday lending. They outlaw this thing.
How high is the rate? Because on my credit cards, it's near 20%.
For a two-week loan of $100, $15 to $20 would be a reasonable interest that you would get from a payday lender. And if you do the math on that, you're around about 400 to 600% interest, which is absolutely gargantuan.
But you got to be a hell of a risk that somebody's going to charge you that much.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're a high-risk entity, right? You're not putting up any collateral for this. You could just walk away. So the payday lender takes on the risk. But this is what politicians will look at, this high rate of interest, and say this is a problem. And so they outlaw the payday lending. So what do you do now? If you're one of these people, it's living paycheck to paycheck, and you need $100 to make it through the next 2 weeks, there are no payday lenders. Well, if you've got a credit card, you could forego making your credit card payment to save up a little bit of money. And if you do that, your credit card's going to charge you a late fee. And the late fee on credit cards, last time I looked, were in the neighborhood of $30 to $40, which is twice what you'd be paying the payday lender. And so the alternative to the payday lender is more expensive. Now, you might say something like, well, okay, but we're talking about poor people here. Maybe they don't have credit cards. Okay, let's talk about checks. Suppose the person needs the extra $100. There's no payday lender, so he writes a check that he can't cover, bounces the check. Check bouncing fees, typically the bank will charge you $30, plus the person you wrote the check to, their bank's going to charge you another $30. Put that together and you're at around 1,500% interest on that $100 bounce check. And so what you see here is, and you see this with so many unintended consequences, we pass the law with the intent of stopping a problem, what we perceive to be a problem, without realizing that this thing we perceive to be a problem is actually the best of the available alternatives. And by shutting it down, you push people into these other worse alternatives.
I think you're actually doing a lot of mental gymnastics here to get around the obvious observation. If this goes away, most poor people who need this will have exactly no options.
You know, I suppose that's the other thing. You may have no option at all, which is you just go hungry.
When government, and I'm thinking very broadly here about all levels of government, when they decide to outlaw a practice in order to, quote, help the poor, they should first look at how many poor people use that practice. Because if there's a lot of people using it, that's probably the best option a lot of these people have. By what authority do you steal people's best alternative? This is kind of like those places that mostly this is at the municipal level where they will outlaw certain foods going to soup kitchens.
Right.
Well, I mean, what the hell's wrong with you? If somebody wants to give edible food to a soup kitchen, we should be thanking our lucky stars. We also saw this in my home state of Connecticut when a barber was volunteering his time to go down to Bushnell Park and give haircuts to the homeless for free. He wasn't allowed to do it. And that was their best option. Why on earth would you take that away?
I recall something round about the beginning of COVID. This would have been right before the COVID lockdowns, that New York City was making it difficult for people to donate food to homeless shelters because they could not document the salt content in the food. And New York had just passed this law saying all the food has to have salt content documented.
Salt content in food is none of the government's business.
Granted, I'm with you there, but even if it were the government's business, we're back at this place of let's pass a law to solve this minor problem, which is knowledge about salt content, and in the process create a much larger problem, which is now nobody can donate food to homeless shelters. And this may be one of the sources of unintended consequences, that when we think about laws, we think about these things from the perspective of reasonable people. And so if someone were to propose that salt content law, and I would come back and say, well, people aren't going to be able to donate to homeless shelters, and a reasonable person would say, well, that's stupid. We just wouldn't enforce the law in those instances. And the thing that people forget is when you write a law, the letter of the law is what gets enforced. There's little recourse to common sense here. The question is not what you intended. The question is, what does the law say?
And if you're looking at something you want to do to benefit others, but that you might be blameworthy if you do it in the eyes of the law, you will not do it. I might want to give all kinds of food to the local soup kitchen, but if it gets to the point where I know I could be arrested for doing it, I'm not showing up.
And you see this kind of thing in all sorts of places. Laws against prostitution, for example. You know, I'm not advocating prostitution, but the fact of the matter is, if you've got a person who's in such a sucky situation that that's their best alternative, and then you take it away, you by definition push them into a worse alternative.
And a lot of these worse alternatives turn out to be death sentences, because that's what happens when laws get passed. Every law contains within it a death penalty.
And if you don't believe us, just don't obey the law. And when they come after you for not obeying it, resist them and see what happens.
Go up to New York City and try selling individual cigarettes out of a pack the way Eric Garner did on a street corner right before the police came and killed him for it. Did they intend to kill him? No. Did anybody go to prison for killing Eric Garner? Absolutely not. That's what law offers.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Matt Ryan joins us this week. Matt is Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University and a valued colleague of mine. His academic research has appeared in Economic Inquiry, the European Journal of Law and Economics, the Journal of Comparative Economics, and Public Choice. In addition, he's published in numerous popular press outlets, including The Atlantic, Bloomberg Businessweek, and The Washington Post. Matt joins us this week to talk about some of his interesting research into human behavior. Matt, welcome to Words and Numbers.
Thank you.
Matt, it's really nice seeing your face again.
We wanted to have you on because there are lots of really interesting things that economists do that touch more on what I call human behavior than traditional economics that I think people are completely unaware of. And I know you do a lot of really interesting things along these lines. So we wanted to have you on to talk about that, to kind of give people a flavor of a different side of economics. Let's start off with the paper you wrote a couple of years back about traffic stops in Pittsburgh.
It's funny. I was thinking about that today and how I came to that topic. What initially I had a GA about 10 years ago, and I kind of stuck them on the Pittsburgh Police Department to try and get data from them. But what I was interested in was data on police rewards. We always hear about $5,000 for this person's capture, information leading to this, leading to that, and kept sending them over to the Pittsburgh Police Department to try to get information on that, and ultimately kind of hit a brick wall, unfortunately. But as a consolation prize, we were able to get this data on all these traffic stops that Pittsburgh had been collecting since 2011. The first paper I wrote on that was looking at just characteristics of frisking by the Pittsburgh Police Department as it pertained to traffic stops. And they tell me that every traffic stop they make gets an entry into their database, whether that's true or not. I have no reason to believe it's not true, but nevertheless, they sent me all 90,000 other traffic stops.
90,000?
About 90,000 traffic stops over those 3 years. I did a paper after that that had about 140,000 traffic stops. But the funny thing was, once I started collecting these data from the Pittsburgh Police Department and writing papers on it, they seem to be pulling over a lot fewer cars. I don't know whether that's causing the rate of that tended to go down a bit. But anyhow, these are loaded things to be talking about. But we found that African-Americans were frisked at higher rates than white drivers were, even more so if you're an African-American male.
So hang on, when you say frisked, you mean like brought out of the car and like they do on TV.
Right.
Okay.
They actually also report the results of that frisk. And so they can say whether they found it was either weapons or contraband or something else. Anyway, they categorize what precisely that they found. And I don't so much like saying at face value, African-Americans are going to be frisked more because it's really an issue of benchmarking. What I think the appropriate statistics to take from that paper are not only are African-Americans frisked at a higher rate, the percentage of unsuccessful frisks on African-Americans is actually considerably higher than that on whites. So African-Americans were frisked between like 6 and 8% more frequently than white drivers were. And the percentage of frisks that were unsuccessful on African-American drivers was about like 60%. And the unsuccessful frisks on whites are about 40%. It's that secondary piece that I think is really important to kind of move along with it, because it's always an issue of benchmarking. An example from the paper is, let's say we test males a lot more frequently than females, but we're testing for Y chromosomes. Does it make more sense to like test males for Y chromosomes? And so there's always this benchmark. And there was a paper by this guy named Ridgway that was looking at the stop and frisk practices in New York City. That's kind of where all this literature comes from. And looking, they have so much more data there, millions and millions of stop and frisk done in New York City. And whatever results you get along racial lines, just because one group is frisked more than the other, that in itself isn't necessarily proof. Because let's say we look in one neighborhood and African-Americans are frisked more frequently than whites are. Maybe that's a neighborhood where more African-Americans live. So we would expect something like that. With these studies, I don't think there's ever one slam dunk that's racial inequity, that's hardcore proof. The data say that and we've settled it. I just think you look at a lot of these studies as a piece of the puzzle. And, you know, it's an important thing to note that African-Americans are going to be frisked more frequently in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at least from 2011 to 2013. It's also interesting to note that the result of those frisks much more infrequently were empty for African-Americans than they were for whites.
Have you gotten any pushback from the Pittsburgh police on this sort of thing?
No. It's always, you know, I tell my students this, they send these papers out and they get published and then do a lot of people read these? Do not too many people read them? No, I haven't myself found myself been pulled over more frequently as a result of this. No, I haven't heard any pushback. And I mean, in the paper, it's important to hedge these results appropriately. Also, as it pertains to stopping and frisking, officers are authorized to do this when they feel threatened or unsafe. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but that's basically it. And so maybe it's the case that officers feel threatened. And so what we said in the paper is, that may satisfy the letter of the law, but this hardly like achieves the spirit of racial equality. There's a lot of things that go into it, but I really wasn't intending on writing a paper about that. And that's kind of what we found. I wrote another paper after that. So there's this heat hypothesis is what it's called. Basically, people get more aggressive when it's hot out. And I'm like, oh man, well, I've got all these traffic stops. I know exactly the time of day these things took place. I could match that up with the National Weather Service and get the temperature that is at the time of the traffic stop and got a lot of pushback for. But what I like to argue is almost this really nice natural experiment of you've got people generally driving in, broadly speaking, air-conditioned cars. You've certainly got cops driving in air-conditioned cars. We've got a traffic stop for whatever behavior of driving had existed. So whatever it did, now we have this little experiment where the cop gets out of the car, has to walk over to the driver. It could be really hot out. It could be really cold out. Do we see any difference in citation behavior? Because that's a subjective decision by the cops. Do we decide to issue citations more frequently when it's hotter out, less frequently, not so? And yeah, they do tend to issue more citations when it's warmer. Did my best to try and say we've controlled for driving behavior as best we can. We're just trying to isolate the impact of heat here. They do seem to issue more citations when it's a little bit warmer out there. And the magnitude of that effect was comparable to the race gap that we found.
I want to throw a possibility on the table and ask a follow-up question. Sure. So the possibility, I think, isn't that you get more citations when it's warm, but you get fewer citations when it's cold. When a cop has to get out of his car in the snow,
in the rain,
very cold, a lot of things pass on the margin.
It could be. I suppose that's the flip side of the same coin. There exists a heat hypothesis, so that's what I had to frame.
I tell students all the time when Ant and I go and talk to them that as an honest and honorable social scientist, there are very few things I can say in terms of conclusion. I rarely get in front of a room and say, this is how it is. I get in front of the room, I think, as you do, and say, okay, here's the evidence and let's think about it. And as a result, you never actually get your foot into that public press pool that makes people famous by saying idiotic things. And I want to know if you've ever been tempted to do it, because I think I have.
Yeah, I think you see enough of the horror stories that I think that temptation subsides after a while. When you were mentioning that, I was realizing and looking through the papers this afternoon just to refresh myself with them. I think my most favorite part or the most enjoyable part of doing research and writing academic papers is coming up with all of the appropriate hedgings for the results that you have. The world is so complex and the data that we have are so imperfect to be able to analyze it in those cases. Let's find something interesting and let's explain with clarity what the data say. But I think the fun part is almost coming up with the six or seven different, yes, but let's realize this, let's realize this, let's realize this. Like all those parts, I think that's what I enjoy the most is coming up with the appropriate context of what it is we're actually looking at. I do a lot of research in wagering markets too. That's a little more cut and dry in terms of what's going on and efficiency. And that's a little more black and white in terms of results and what you see and what you don't, what the numbers say, as opposed to something as nuanced as, can we assess police behavior on the margin of race? Can we assess police behavior on the margin of temperature? I have another paper I wrote too that looks at the number of passengers in the car. Does that impact the rates at which you get tickets or not? So whenever it's human behavior, it's so much more nuanced and you have to be careful. You can't say too much. Fortunately, I'm wired that I enjoy not trying to say too much. I like pulling it back as opposed to saying the audacious.
As economists, we've got this problem that we can't conduct controlled experiments, or very rarely can we conduct controlled experiments. And so we look for, where possible, natural experiments. One of the papers related to what you're mentioning now, as I recall, was a natural experiment, and you were asking the question, do police pull over black drivers more often than white drivers? And your experiment was to compare what happens during the day versus at night, when they can see the color of the driver versus they can't.
Yeah, so that's a theory called the veil of darkness, and that's received some attention. Let's be abundantly clear, I didn't come up with that. That was a guy from the Ivy Leagues that came up with that idea. And there have been a handful of tests of that. Some of the more recent papers that have looked at that have gotten really creative, being able to get really pointed location information on where a traffic stop actually exists, and then they chart where the streetlights are to get ambient lighting. I believe the results are mixed. I know it's not a landslide one way or the other on those data. I tried to look at that a little bit myself because, again, I know the hours in which the traffic stops take place. You have time of year effects, which are different, and then there's weather is going to play into it too. I was trying to exploit basically hours right around daylight savings time, so like a bump up in an hour, a bump down an hour, to try and control for a lot of those things.
So it's the same time of day, but the light has changed.
Right, because driving behavior is different in the morning than the afternoon than at night. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to control for all that. Doing an experiment like that. And the problem is you're losing so much. I just didn't have the statistical strength to really be able to say anything of power. I presented it at a conference at some point years ago, but it was fun to talk about it. The idea is just the data I had couldn't really speak to it, unfortunately.
James, you don't want to ask about wagering markets?
I do. I thought it was off limits until we were done with the other thing.
No, go ahead.
This driving business is fantastic and all, but I really want to get to the wagering markets because...
You and the students.
That's right. I'm going to ask the same question they ask, and you can slap me around for it after. How should I approach my wagering life?
Whenever I give public talks about wagering, I invariably get some form of the same question over and over. They're like, if you've done so much work into this and you understand how these markets work, I have a paper that says wagering early in the baseball season could be profitable. So they said, well, if you figure this out, then why are you still here? Why are you still doing this? And right. My response is, for someone that does research in wagering markets, I am awfully risk averse and gamble very infrequently. Baseball games are fun. So the Rivers here in Pittsburgh is a casino and they have an online sports book and they had a promotion where if I deposited $100 or something, then they'd match that $100. But you have to gamble $100 worth to get your free $100. And I'm like, that's great. I've spent plenty of years looking at baseball wagering markets. I can tread water in that all day long. So I've made a bunch of $5 wagers over the years. And so I got my free money from the Rivers. But I've done some papers on horse racing and dog racing markets. I don't have any active advice. Remember the guy on Jeopardy that won, I don't know, 30, 40 games in a row a couple years back? He was a professional sports wager, still is, lives in Vegas. He has a column in The Athletic that he writes once a month and addresses that issue. Like, he's a professional. He knows how to do it. He's bankroll management and everything through and through. It's tremendously interesting to get into the mind of someone like that. if you're looking for what to do, I will push you to the professionals page and have him tell you how to do it. Don't bet on the Red Sox. Should I say that? Don't bet on the Red Sox.
You should not say that. Be quiet.
The go-to example that I have in class when I talk about baseball wagering, and I know you'll appreciate this, is so the first paper I wrote early in the season, there seemed to be some reasons to believe that wagering on underdogs on a money line wager early in the season could be profitable, maybe persistently profitable. And then after the paper was published, it wasn't. And so we wrote another paper to say how it went away. But the example I always like to use in class is, man, students here. So in 2008, 14 years ago, they were toddlers running around.
Right.
I go, for most of your adult life or most of your life that you remember, you've known the Tampa Bay Rays as a competently run baseball team. They don't spend a lot of money. They seem to get a lot of prospects. They seem to do pretty well. And that's great. What I need to impress upon you is before 2008, they were horrible, like really, really bad, like never had a winning season ever. And it's funny to look back in 2008 because they made the World Series and they're actually really good, but they played a series at Fenway in 2008. And what did we know in 2008? Well, we knew that Tampa Bay had never had a winning record ever as a franchise, and the Red Sox had just won the World Series. Tampa Bay was a massive underdog in that series because why wouldn't they be? And they swept the series because it turns out they were pretty good and Boston wasn't. But any example I can get in class that kind of undercuts Boston in any way possible, I kind of really make certain to get that in there.
You're a real peach. That's what we all love about you. But anyway, I guess none of what you said is all that shocking. Let's take a backward step. What are the big takeaways from your research in wagering markets?
As a free market guy myself, I think there's no more distillation of the efficiency and remarkable ability of prices to coordinate things than there are in wagering markets. If you look at horse racing in particular, you've got races happening all over the globe that people can bet on from anywhere in the world. And all these different people betting what they believe and using their information. And we end up with these prices that are so staggeringly efficient and so, so close to what the true outcome ends up being at the end of the day. If we end up seeing a participant that the market says should have a 33% chance of winning, that entrant is winning 33% of the time. It's remarkable to me, all these different individuals just pursuing their interest. We've set up a market, let prices go where they may. That's what I think the big takeaway is. I realize the papers that get published are those that find where things are going to be inefficient. But even in that case, just by the statistical tests, we're not talking 10 feet inefficient. We're talking maybe a millimeter or two inefficient. And that's only just from a statistical test that's giving you a certain level of power. These markets are remarkably efficient. I always say, look, I love markets. I love free markets. I love prices that can move around, all of that. I said, is the strawberry market efficient? I don't know. And that's really hard to test. There's a lot of things you got to control for. It's stiff and you got sticky prices. There's just a lot you got to deal with regards to that. We have a theory that says it should be, but it's kind of hard to test. Wagering markets are beautiful for testing things like that. They're like an asset that has a defined value at a known time and people act accordingly. And I think it's a great way to be analyzing how people behave. It's a great testament to the strength of markets. I've just always been super, super interested in them. And being tenured, that's what I can go and look at 24/7.
It's weird, Matt, because upon a time, I used to bet a lot in football and in boxing. After a while, when you step back and you look at your behavior versus outcomes, it ended up looking to me like everything I did was more or less random. It was luck one way or the other because the lines are so good that you got nothing to hang your hat on unless you happen to be in the locker room before the game and see something that you shouldn't have seen. It makes a lot of sense not to bet football.
Yeah. To be fair, James Holzhauer made a living doing this before he went on Jeopardy, and he's still doing it, and he's writing about it. And looking a little bit under the hood, it's basically you don't end up being successful in these markets by betting it all on the Bengals to cover the 4.5 in the Super Bowl. Like, that's not how you do it. It's basically lots and lots of small wins. You shop around between books, and if you feel something is right, then get the best line for it. You win this in accumulating pennies. You don't win this by accumulating huge, huge paychecks. If you're willing to put in the work to do that, here are the skills that you need and things to look for and things that have been successful for me. But in terms of what James was just saying, in terms of being like, I kind of like the Pirates today, like their pitcher, let's go wager on them. You're just flipping coins at that point. You know that the expected return on any wager is going to be negative. So it's a losing proposition. It's like playing slot machines, basically.
You're talking about wagering, but what you've seen, James, also happens in the stock market for the very same reason. that all the information is already incorporated into the prices. The only way you can pick a winner is that you have some inside information. Now, you'll have people, and they'll publish books who've made billions of dollars in the stock market, and they say, here's the trick. No, what happened was, by random chance, they lucked out, and they confused their luck for skill.
See also Bitcoin.
Yeah, very much so.
And the research on fund managers, I think, shows that there really aren't any persistent long-term success stories in terms of fund managers. It's largely a random walk.
Yeah, that's why the best advice is you buy into the stock market and then you walk away. You come back 20 years later and look at your portfolio.
The index funds seem to do better than the managed funds, and those are no load. You're not paying somebody to deal with that. Hard to see how that's not the right approach.
Yeah. In any given year, you could have someone outperform the market. But in terms of when you start looking year to year to year to year, it kind of falls.
But there's an interesting story here about the wisdom of the masses. I ran across a video just last week. For the life of me, I can't remember what it was that they were asking about. But they're asking some innocuous question, like there's this hybrid bull and how much it weighs, or some innocuous question like this. And they were asking experts, and then they were asking the guy in the street. And if you take the average of what the guy in the street says, the guy in the street's better than the experts. And the argument is that the random guy in the street, he might be high, he might be low, but you get enough of them, the highs and the lows average out, and you end up at a pretty decent answer. And that's exactly what goes on with prices and with wagering.
Absolutely. So the initial thought when it came to studying wagering markets and sports books, with the sports books were trying to get equal money on both sides. If you're just talking about a traditional like point spread wager, the initial thought was that if I can get Ant to bet $20 on the Bengals and I can get James to bet $20 on the Rams, I know whoever wins, I'm paying $38 to, I guarantee myself $2. That was the initial balanced book theory is what they want. But now there seems to be increasing evidence, quite a bit of evidence, that people seem to note that books are taking an active stake in some of these games.
Yep.
They have models, they run it, and they feel that they can maybe get an edge up on the market as a whole. There's a pretty good amount of evidence that's showing that's the case now. And so the idea is, if you're going to be wagering and doing a lot of wagering, then have your model, stick with it, and don't play from the gut. If your model says this, then do this, and then try and have a long-term view of it. If you really feel you're better off, then it's got to be a long-term thing. So that's where people stand.
I'm glad you got into that, because I can't pinpoint a year when I think it happened. But every year I'm in a NFL pick'em. You pick all the games every week. And, you know, it's a fun thing to do with people you know, not a way to make
sure.
A lot of money.
Of course.
And I can remember looking at the spreads early in the season thinking something different is happening here. That these spreads I would not have seen in previous years. I'm sure that it was around the time that the sports books started picking winners instead of balancing the action.
Yeah, it could be. It was the initial theory that they were going to have this balanced book.
Well, we all heard that years ago.
Right.
Everybody knew this.
That was the starting point. And then people started to question that. It could be the case. I don't know one way or the other. It could be the case that books never behaved like that. It could be the case they always felt they had an information advantage and they were never trying to sit there and just balance it on both sides. Maybe or maybe not. I have not seen anything along those lines. It's interesting, too, because we always ask students in class, there's so many people employed by these books to try and come up with models, try and come up with lines. This is a big business. Students like to ask, well, how did this happen in 1950 before you could run everything on your cell phone? How did people end up working this stuff out? And I don't know offhand, but you got to figure it was people that had been doing it for years and years and years, have the experience, would think that they've seen everything and they're the ones that are setting lines. But now it's so computer heavy, so model heavy.
It took the criminal element right out of this, because bookies were almost always working behind a storefront in a neighborhood. There was a network of them. They all answered to the same organized crime figures. And before you know it, they actually had something that looks like the arrangement we have now. They just did it all by hand. And it's interesting, because when you see Vegas moving to these sorts of things, simultaneous with Vegas moving away from organized crime, it gets really interesting. It's an above the water exercise that you can look at a little bit.
For sure. I've been teaching sports econ here, and that's where I teach the wagering market stuff. I've been teaching sports econ here at Duquesne for 10 years or so, let's say. I remember the first time we came into class, and I've got my little wagering market segment that I do for a couple of weeks in class. And I remember going in there and saying, all right, here's what we're going to be doing next. And the kids in the room kind of looking to the left and looking to the right, like, are we really going to do this? Are we going to talk about these things? Just the aura around wagering has changed so much. I say this in class too. Turn on ESPN right now. What are you going to see crawling across the bottom? We've got a couple of Sweet 16 games that are going to be played tonight, and you'll say who's playing and maybe their records. And then right after it, you'll have the line. Their lives have been that. I can't express to you guys, if you transported yourself 30 years back, how that never would have flown.
Right.
Never.
Ever would have flown 30 years from now. It was such a taboo to do that. And even in the 10 years I've been teaching sports econ now, students are like, I have them do prop betting on the Super Bowl. I give them a hypothetical $1,000 and see who can make the most money. When I first handed it out, I had to explain what a prop bet was. I had to really get into it and teach them how to do this. This is supposed to be just an off-the-cuff exercise. Turns into a half-hour event in class to really explain what's going on. Now, hand out the prop sheet. I think I had a question from class. They don't know what's going on. Like, they know exactly what's going on. I also like telling the story in class, too, of wagering being a bad thing. There was a Home Improvement episode, Tim Allen, years ago, where the moral of the story was, oh, you know, wagering's bad, so don't do that. I've never really saw it like that. It's individuals. It's an uncertain event. People wager every day in their lives, whether they realize it or not.
Right.
I always like to say, you know, who here has got an appliance recently? Best Buy or wherever you got it from. They raise their hand. Did you get the extended warranty? Because they always ask you that when you buy it. And they say, no, that's, you're wagering on your appliance then.
Right.
It's a financial stake in an uncertain future. Now, I can say the same thing for ticket scalping, by the way. When I was growing up, yeah. Oh, it's very seedy. Secondary market's very, very seedy, and people were prosecuted for that stuff. And now I think it's with the emergence of StubHub, I really think is what did it. I'm in my office. I'm 1,000 feet from PPG Paints Arena where the Penguins play. And when I leave, I drive right by it. The people are outside like, I need tickets. Like, I mean, they're just right there. No one cares anymore. Markets are going to be strong. Embrace them.
You're absolutely right. Talking about sports betting on TV was such a no-go for so many years. And then Jimmy the Greek shows up and it's like this 3-minute segment where, okay, we're just going to talk about this and you'll get Jimmy's picks and all that. All of a sudden, what, in the last 2-3 years, the lines are everywhere.
Everywhere.
They're right on the TV screen. There's a show on ESPN that discusses the lines for the upcoming week. They finally threw in the towel and said, okay, we're all in. I've got a casino not more than 8 miles from my house. They opened a sports book this year because everybody's opening a sports book this year. You can gamble online every minute of every day about almost anything. It's a brave new world.
It is. And I always laugh when I go to Britain because they've had more of a culture of wagering on things for longer than we have.
Yeah, yeah.
There's little corner side things that bet on like what color hat the queen's going to wear that day. I mean, they bet on everything over there. They do. There is still some variation in laws across states with regards to sports wagering and what have you. And best I could tell, I think if not all 50, then 45 or more are going to end up there. I would think all 50 are eventually going to end up there. Pennsylvania got into the game earlier than a lot of states did. And the reason that was is they had that lawsuit that was in New Jersey that ultimately changed all of this. They had legislation written up and passed through committees and ready to go the second this decision came through, if it came through in the way that they thought it was going to come through. And so that went through. There were a number of states that were like that, that had legislation ready to go. And those are the states that adopted it first. Different states are in different stages of the process, but I'd be surprised if there are any states 20 years from now.
What is this lawsuit you're talking about?
It was in New Jersey. The name of it is escaping me, so I'm not going to try and make it up. I believe it had to do with the ability to, was it wager mobily? I'm totally blanking on the specifics of it, but I'm pretty sure it was in New Jersey. And once that got settled, it was pretty clearly understood that any state could allow this sports wagering.
I see.
Yeah, it just opened up the entire country.
Floodgates.
And I'm going to take issue with you. It's not going to be 50 states. It's going to be 49, and Utah right. will never do it.
Yeah. You don't think so?
No.
I'll defer to your Utah knowledge on that one.
No, that's right. You've got a problem with pornography and coffee. Trust me, sports betting is going to fall right into that category.
Well, maybe I'll get you on this one. Maybe Washington, D.C. will be the 51st state, and then we still will have 50 and not Utah. How's that sound?
Right. We should have a wager on that.
We could have a wager on that. We could absolutely do that.
So the argument, I presume, against wagering is that what it would lead to, people would be wagering their paychecks and bankruptcy and destitution, all of that. Has anyone done a study to ask the question if any of that actually came to pass?
With regards to the sports wagering stuff, I'm certain in the ensuing years, you're going to see a lot of studies that are going to be like that, that exploit the variation in laws passing across different states to try and isolate some of those effects. What I can see is when they look at wagering activity, that would be like sports wagering specifically. with regards to casinos and such, most of the studies that I've seen, for the most part, show there to be increased, perhaps, criminal activity around casinos, but perhaps can't eliminate the idea that we're going to see increased criminal activity where we see people gathering anyway. And it didn't seem to be beyond that amount. So yes, we have people getting together in casinos. There is some crime that's around that, but it's hard to attribute it specifically to the casino.
As opposed to just any public gathering, right?
Yeah, like a football game or something. Yeah,
right, sure.
I remember when marijuana legalization was becoming a thing that's happening over the years in different states with different laws and all that. And I remember going to a panel discussion and talking to an economist. So the American Economic Association is the big annual meeting for economists, and it's where a lot of interviews take place where grad students are interviewing for jobs. And I remember talking to an economist. He's like, yeah, I guess it's going to be a couple of years until all the job market people are going to be doing the marijuana papers and exploiting all the differences in laws that are passed. 2019 is going to be the marijuana year, or whatever that's going to be. I remember him saying that. And I feel like in a couple of years, you're going to see some sports wagering societal impact papers trying to exploit the different legalities across the states.
Well, this has been a nice opportunity to give people an insight into some of the fun stuff that economists do that aren't what people would normally think of as economics. But there are a lot of economists who do stuff like this. Unfortunately, the economists who are shown on the news are all macroeconomists who talk about unemployment and inflation, all of that. Those of us who actually do interesting things don't make it to the evening news.
I always have said that in economics, you could either do existing research a little bit better, or you can kind of be the first person to do stuff. And I've always kind of like being the latter. I don't know. I've always kind of like looking in new areas where people really haven't done it. It's a lot more work to do it that way, unfortunately. But I don't know. It's always interesting. One of my advisors in grad school told me to always run paper ideas by my mom.
Huh.
She's not an economist at all. She finds it interesting, then maybe I've got something on my hands here.
Yeah, good advice. Matt, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us. And I don't know how it is we didn't manage to have you on before this, but we hope you'll come back.
For certain. What you guys have built here is very, very impressive. And I enjoy it and appreciate it. And I'm more than willing to come back if you guys have me.
I think right around Super Bowl time might make a lot of sense.
There we go.
We'll do some prop wagering. It'll be fun.
Yeah, that's right. You will tell us which props make more sense.
I'll
than
be
others.
Abundantly clear. So I give the kids a hypothetical $1,000. I think the kid that won this year was actually a football player, believe it or not. And I think he turned his $1,000 into $1,700. And I, being the professor and savant and know-it-all, had the joy of turning my $1,000 into about $400.
That makes sense.
I also do an NCAA tournament pool with my students as well, because it's fun and why not? And one of the girls in my class who admits she does not follow college basketball at all is, I think, in the 99.7th percentile nationwide of how well she's doing with her brackets. So,
wow.
You never know. These are chance events. I can't control chance any better than anyone else. And students like doing better than me. So
I wonder if there's any effect. You say she doesn't follow it. Is that have an effect? She has no emotional attachment.
My dad went to the University of Arizona, so I very clearly picked Arizona to win the national title, of course, easily. I will be the first to admit I have an emotional attachment when I fill these things out.
Yeah.
Last night punished me for my emotional attachment, so there you go.
As a resident of Tucson, I can tell you that the locals are cheesed about this. They are not happy.
Which is funny, because if you asked them a year ago if you'd be number one seed, they'd probably be pretty amped up because the program was not in very good shape. But recency bias, I guess.
Yep, what can you do? That's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Be sure to join us next week when, I don't know, we talk about more sports? Yeah, probably not. This was the max for Ant, and there's no way we're ever getting back to it. Anyway, until next week, you can follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. We're going to give you a bunch of contact information and links for one Professor Matt Ryan as well, so go and check out all of his things. In the meantime, you can talk with us a little more on Words and Numbers Backstage, where the conversation continues, and
you can send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Let's try to be nice to each other just a little bit. It doesn't have to be uncomfortable. It doesn't have to be a public show. Just be nice to each other just a little and see if that maybe gives you a better trajectory. Guys, I'll see you all later.
Thanks, James.
See you next week.